Introduction. Crime and the Millennium. The most horrific crime of the late 20th century will almost certainly never be described fully in print, and that is undoubtedly just as well. On the afternoon of Sunday, June the 2nd, 1985, an assistant at a San Francisco hardware store noticed a customer leaving without paying for a $75 vice and called a policeman outside. The would-be thief was a bespectacled youth who, when he saw the policeman, ran away, leaving a bearded older man standing by the open boot of a car into which he had just placed the vice. The older man explained that his companion had walked out without thinking and offered to pay for the vice. The policeman pointed to a wrapped package in the boot and asked, "What's in there?" It proved to be a .22 pistol with a silencer. Since this was illegal, the policeman told the man he would have to accompany him to headquarters. There, the bearded man gave his name as Robin Stapley and showed his driving license. As the policeman went off to check with a computer, the man asked for a glass of water. Before they could stop him, he put a plastic capsule in his mouth and swallowed it. As he slumped forward, the police assumed that he'd had a heart attack. In fact, he had swallowed a cyanide capsule. Papers in the man's pocket led the police to a small ranch in Calaveras County, and he was finally identified as Leonard Lake, a man with a police record for burglary. The young man who escaped was apparently called Charles Ung. When the police investigated the ranch, they found that the master bedroom had hooks in the ceiling and chains in a box, which were probably intended to hang from them. There were a series of photographs of women in their underwear, many of whom looked as if they were not happy about posing. A cabinet of homemade videos left no doubt that Lake and Ung had been taking girls prisoner, raping and torturing them, then killing them. Lake's fantasy was to possess women as sex slaves. One couple, Brenda O'Connor and her boyfriend, had been invited for dinner and had brought their 2-year-old baby. The man and the baby were killed, and Brenda O'Connor was raped and tortured for days before she was murdered. She was one of many. The garden proved to contain several bodies and a large quantity of human bones. One of the bodies was of Robin Stapley, the man whose driver's license Lake had offered as ID. Leonard Lake, it seemed, was a survivalist, one of those who believed he would need an underground bunker in the case of atomic war, and had built one at the ranch, stocking it with tinned food. He was an ex-marine who had been discharged with psychiatric problems. Both his parents had been alcoholics, and he had been raised by a strict disciplinarian grandmother, which had made him violently anti-authoritarian. His younger brother was an epileptic who was sadistic to cats and tried to rape his sisters. Lake protected them in exchange for sex. He liked to photograph them nude and later became a maker of porn movies. Later, the brother would become one of Lake's many victims. Lake lived in a world of fantasy, boasting of daring exploits in Vietnam, where, in fact, he had never seen combat. He had lived as a burglar and fence, and later at the ranch had obtained things to sell, such as cars, simply by murdering their owners. One couple, for example, who were camping nearby, simply vanished together with their belongings. Lake also left behind a journal of murder. Joel Norris, a psychiatrist who studied it, comments that it shows increasing disillusion. Lake had written, "There is no problem with a sexually submissive woman." But his search for ultimate fulfilment had evidently left him with a sense of diminishing returns. Ung, who had escaped, was eventually captured in Alberta, Canada, while stealing from a department store. He was the son of a wealthy Hong Kong couple, but had been a juvenile delinquent. After his arrest and years in prison in Canada, he was transferred back to California. But 12 years after his capture, there had still been no trial. Why? The reason is not known, but two things are obvious. First, that since he's shown on video raping and killing girls, there can be no possible doubt of his guilt. Second, it would hardly be in the public interest to allow the full evidence to emerge in court. If ever there was a case for suppressing evidence and restricting freedom of information, this is it. There was a parallel case in Toronto, Canada, in 1995. A good-looking young man called Paul Bernardo kidnapped 2 schoolgirls and, with his wife's cooperation, spent days treating them as sex slaves until he murdered them, then dismembered and disposed of their bodies. He also videotaped the whole procedure, as well as many other rapes, including that of his wife's younger sister, who died after the assault. These tapes were shown in court so that the rapes could be studied in detail. They were not as horrific as the Lake videos. Bernardo never tortured his victims. yet even reading descriptions of them in books about the case induces feelings of nausea. What's happening? In my opinion, it is an inevitable consequence of the age of sex crime. In 1888, the Jack the Ripper murders shocked the whole world because it seemed inconceivable that anyone could be so wicked as to murder and dismember women. The Victorians were sentimental. They cried buckets of tears at the death of Little Nell, and the idea of sex crime seemed a terrifying new development in sheer evil that they preferred not to think about. Besides, in the poverty and misery of Victorian cities, street girls were so cheap that the notion of committing murder for sex seemed ridiculous. But that would gradually change in the new century. The comedy filmmaker Max Sennett made his fortune with Bathing Beauties, and although the bathing costumes now strike us as demure, at the time of the First World War they made American males sit up and notice. Then came the 1920s, the jazz age, with flappers in short skirts, and slowly sex became a commercial product, as it is in modern TV advertisements. For example, where the viewer's attention is caught by a pair of shapely legs, then by something that drops down around the feet, all so quickly that it's impossible to see what it is. But the implication is clear. She has lost her pants. And we can begin to see why we now have sex criminals like Leonard Lake and Paul Bernardo. We're encouraged to see sex as a highly desirable commodity, just as children are encouraged to want designer jeans and sneakers costing £100. I'm not suggesting that we should return to the age of Puritanism or Victorian prudery, merely that we should try to understand some of the strange crimes that are beginning to happen as we approach the millennium. Why do so many computer hackers do it just for fun? Why do some computer freaks enjoy spreading viruses? Why do big cities like Los Angeles have a problem with stranger murders, in which thugs kill people they've never met, sometimes even without the motive of robbery? As we prepare for the 21st century, these questions are becoming increasingly urgent. Fortunately, there are new reasons for optimism. For example, Paul Bernardo was caught by a new discovery called DNA fingerprinting, made by Alec Jeffries, a scientist from my hometown, Leicester, in September 1984. DNA forms, of course, the basic building blocks of life, and comes in long strings of molecules shaped like a double helix. Jeffries isolated certain blocks of DNA and then mass-produced them and learned to stain them with radioactivity. He then took an X-ray film of the block and saw that it came out as a long column with black stripes against a white background. This is the genetic fingerprint. Next, he took samples of blood from whole families and set out to see if there was any family resemblance. There was. A child's genetic fingerprint was a combination of those of its parents. Unlike real fingerprints, genetic fingerprints are not unique, but the odds of two unrelated people sharing one are about 4 million to 1. In the late 1980s, there had been a long series of rapes in the Toronto suburb of Scarborough. Paul Bernardo came under suspicion because he resembled a composite sketch of the rapist, and a sample of his blood was taken. But he was one of more than 200 suspects, and when he heard nothing more, he assumed that he was in the clear. It took nearly 2 years for the lab to process his sample and to conclude that he was the Scarborough rapist. By then, he had murdered the two schoolgirls. But his wife, Carla, formerly Homolka, with whom he had a sadomasochistic relationship, became alarmed when she was questioned by the police and subsequently confessed to the relations with whom she was staying. The result was that Bernardo was finally arrested and eventually sentenced to life imprisonment. DNA fingerprinting means that the rapist's chances of getting away with it are as small as those of the burglar who leaves his fingerprint behind. Another important development has taken a step towards solving the problem of the serial killer, a criminal type later discussed in this book. In the 1970s, the new FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia, began to develop a method called psychological profiling. The study of dozens of murderers revealed that they had left behind a kind of personality fingerprint on their crimes, and that experienced profilers could often tell, from the details of a crime, what sort of person had committed it. In a case with several different suspects, this could save the police a great deal of work. In September 1977, a schoolgirl named Julie Whitmire vanished on her way home, and her naked body was found the next day. The police of Platte City, Kansas, decided to ring the new behavioural unit at Quantico. The unit studied the case, then sent back an opinion that the killer was a sexually frustrated loner, probably of low intelligence and more than average physical development. This fitted a teenager named Mark Sager, who was on the list of suspects. Under further interrogation, Sager soon confessed to the rape murder. In the 1980s, the police in Anchorage, Alaska, were investigating a case in which performers from topless bars and strip joints were vanishing, later being found naked and dead in shallow graves. One 17-year-old prostitute had complained to the police that she had been tortured in a basement by a local businessman, Robert Hansen, but had managed to escape as he tried to take her to his private plane. Hansen denied it and produced an alibi backed by two respectable business associates. Anchorage police gave the FBI unit a description of Hansen, a little, pockmarked, red-headed man who was proud of his skills as a hunter and collected trophies. The FBI replied that Hansen fitted the profile of the person who would commit such murders, and that he would almost certainly have kept trophies of his victims. On that advice, the Anchorage police informed Hansen's businessman friends that they would be required to swear their alibi in front of a grand jury, and would be subject to imprisonment if they were proved to have lied. They quickly confessed that their alibis had been untrue, given simply to oblige a friend. Hansen was then arrested, and a search warrant obtained for his house. As predicted, the police found trophies taken from his victims, as well as the rifle that had been used to kill most of the women. Faced with this evidence, Hansen admitted that he had picked up prostitutes for oral sex, and that if they declined, he forced them to strip at gunpoint, and then hunted them as if they were game, until he found them and killed them. The killing, he said, was an anticlimax. What gave him pleasure was stalking them. Hansen was sentenced to life imprisonment. Such advances in criminology mean that at least new methods of detection are keeping up with new crimes. Whether these advances can make life less hazardous for the citizens of the 21st century is, I have to admit, something about which we can only hope. Finally, I owe the reader an apology. The articles in this book were written in the early 1970s for a magazine partwork called Crimes and Punishment, on which I was the consulting editor. Each issue contained a famous case, a famous trial, and an article devoted to the history of the subject. My job was to write the histories. Naturally, there would be no point in discussing the subjects covered in the famous cases and the famous trial, but I often referred to them, because the reader merely had to turn the page to find out what I was talking about. Well, this is obviously not true in this volume, and I've done my best to remove such references. Unfortunately, this has not always been possible. So if the reader finds a reference in the article on traitors to Roger Casement, or on homicidal doctors to Sam Shepard, who incidentally has now been officially declared innocent, this is the explanation.